You are listening to listener-supported radio, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, 89.5 FM. And because of your support, I can bring you a jazz legend right now. Rufus Reed, are you there?
I'm here.
Yes. Is it hard to be called a legend when you're actually still alive? Do you mind?
Well, it usually equates with old. And I mean, it's people are being respectful and whatnot. I don't mind it so much, but it just means I've been around a while.
Indeed. When did you start playing the bass? How old were you, and when was your first professional work?
Boy. Well, I began to teach myself the bass. I was a trumpet player in middle school and junior high and high school, and I was in the Air Force band. I was going to get drafted, and so I joined
the
Air Force.
Okay.
They promised me that I could be in the band, and I passed the audition, and that's what I did. But I began to still be intrigued by the bass, but I began to teach myself. So I guess I was about 19 or 18, actually, because I graduated from high school at 17. My mother had to sign for me, so yeah, that's about right. I was 18 when I began to just start studying the bass, and this was like 1962.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask you how you wound up in the Air Force, because it just didn't seem like a jazz musician's best next step, but I guess you had no choice, is that right?
Well, I was either going to get drafted, and the trumpet was a lot better than carrying a rifle at the time.
Oh, amen.
So, the Army was, if I had gone to college at that time, or maybe if I had been married at that time, and I didn't really want to do any of those things, particularly at that time, but I was going to get drafted. That was a foregone conclusion. So so someone told me about the Air Force, and I said, well, let me give it a try, and I passed the audition by the skin of my teeth, but I still passed it, and basically, it's changed my whole life.
Indeed. You know, the trumpet and the bass, now mind you, this is coming from someone who's not a musician, but they seem like incredibly different instruments to me.
Well,
did you have...
Yeah. They really are. But I had always been intrigued, and in retrospect, I began to really realize, because I was in a group in high school, like a small group, and every time we took a little break when we were rehearsing, I'd always just kind of walk over to the bass and just kind of plunk on it. That was a kind of an infatuation that I didn't know really was going to be so significant in my life, particularly at that time, you know. But I think that's when I just liked the way it felt and what it did and with the music and... But I still couldn't play it, but I began to teach myself when I was in the military because I had a lot of time on my hands.
Mm-hmm. An ideal time, right, too?
Yeah.
Hey, and so, you know, let me ask you, though. You are known specifically for having a very, very unique sound on the bass. What do you attribute that to?
I have no idea.
Good answer, okay.
I love the sound of the bass. My hero, particularly when I saw him play live, was Ray Brown, and he had this enormous sound, but really clear and articulate, and he had so much fun. But so I said, I want to do that, whatever that was. Of course, you might want to do it, but don't know if you could do it.
Mm.
But he certainly was a very influential for the sound and the power that he had. But I began to listen to a lot of different players, and I began to realize that they all had their own kind of sound. But some people seem to think that because of the sound that the trumpet just is a lot more melodic. It's a percussive instrument in that it's part of the rhythm section, I don't know. I don't like the quote unquote thumpy kind of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Even the great players like Milt Hinton and the much older players, when they were supposedly thump, everybody else was thumping, but they weren't. For some reason, their sound was clearer. The pitch was better, etc. So, and I'm fumbling here because I don't really know why or how I have the sound that I like, you know, or people like.
Well, to me, you know, your experience, you know, begins with, you know, just about every major jazz artist that I can think of. It's, you know, Dexter Gordon, Thad Jones. The problem with doing a interview in 20, 25 minutes is if I started to list everybody you played with, that would be the end of the interview. But I think when I was asking the question, I should have framed it maybe a little better, because I was wondering, you know, what influence those jazz musicians had. I mean, did they say to you, I want to get this sound? I know Miles Davis is renowned for asking people to play a certain way. I mean, was that part of the reason, do you think?
No. Although I played a great deal with, I mean, as you say, with some fantastic people, but Eddie Harris was my first boss, and he was just about, it was all about the music. Just, if you're going to play a ballad, you play beautiful. If you're going to play funk, you play it funky. If you're going to play bebop, you play bebop. And they all have a rhythmic approach to them. Each one of those styles. And then when we played avant-garde or without a key center or whatever, he wanted that, and we used to do that every day. So and every gig. So consequently, it was like not being afraid, but of any kind of music, and be very conscious about how you sound. So you can. It was only four of us, you know. So we had to be heard with some kind of clarity.
You know, when we had lunch in December, one of the things I was thinking about, besides trying not to, like, fall over that I was actually having lunch with Rufus Reed, but besides that, you know, we talked about Bradley's, and I had the opportunity to see you there, you know, and, you know, one of the things that I remember was how fortunate I felt to be able to watch you so clearly. It's just an amazing feat what you're doing, and to, you know, you do you feel like you're embodied with rhythm, or is that something that you really had to work on developing?
No, it just makes sense to me. I think that's one of the natural, you know, I just understand that there's things that some people you can kind of study it and you can be with it. I've had students who were incredible technicians, but they had no real feeling, perhaps, you know, and they could play technically incredibly so, and yet they had difficulty with that aesthetic thing, that you know that natural thing that makes people want to pat their foot or shake their head. And some of that you can't really, teach that. I mean, I think through osmosis you can maybe become close to it if you have the aptitudes and whatnot. But it just makes sense to me. And the bass is so fulfilling for me that I can't imagine playing another instrument.
You know, one of my great regrets is, of course, this would mean that I had some musical aptitude, which, of course, I have none. But I would have loved to have sat in on some of your classes at William Patterson. That I think that, you know, the fact that you built that beautiful jazz program there is such a you know, another feather in your already, you know, featherfold cap.
Well, you know, that was an amazing time for me because I helped develop that curriculum, and the players who came in, most of them already had that natural thing. They understood, but they were there to just, they were almost like diamonds in the rough, and I was there, and with the other coaches that we had with them, were to help polish them up a little bit before they actually got in the street. And that was to me was the most challenging and the most fun and the most rewarding part about it.
What was, I mean, I know this would be a long answer, but in short, I mean, what were you trying to accomplish with the curriculum? Were you, did you have a, you know, a modus operandi, or were you just trying to, you know, create a runway for people to go into the jazz arena in New York City?
Well, yes. My coordinator, Dr. Martin Criven, who was actually gave me my head to try and develop the program, he said, we just want to build a pipeline to the marketplace, directly to the marketplace, which happened to be New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was, so they could leave us and then they could go to a city like New York and play well enough that people would listen.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't ready, they knew right away. And because we had professionals who were in the marketplace as the coaches, as the teachers. And in other words, we were trying to develop players that we want to play with us, that we want them to play with us, and et cetera. And as opposed to just passing a course and getting a decent grade.
And you're saying that some students early on got, you know, they just didn't have what it was going to take to do it.
Well, many of there are many players that have the passion, they have that technical ability, they have the passion aesthetically to do it, but they don't have the ability with the connection to their instrument to actually fulfill it. I mean, there were young players who wanted it really bad, but in reality, after a while, it was, we tried to make it really clear that maybe they should do something else.
Mm-hmm. You know, for me, always, it has been, and you know, my ear is critical enough, right, that I could say, I can always tell you when there's an A player and when there's a B player and when there's a C player. And I know what you're saying.
It's, absolutely.
I mean, as an audience member, I can pluck that out. And I'm sure that I'm not all that unique in jazz clubs to be able to say, well, that person's not exactly playing as well as I wish that they were.
No, but there is a lot of truth in that, because there was a student, I used to do these summer workshops with a guy by the name of Jamie Ebersold, and he's become quite well known all over the world for these educational books and things that he's put together. And we would do these summer camps, and there was one kid, I'll never forget, it was like, I think Dave Liebman was on the faculty with me, and Ed Solf, and really some strong players. But this kid could not, he wanted to be there, but he really didn't have what it took to really be a good player. However, he came up to me, he says, Mr. Reed, you know, when I listen to you and Mr. Liebman play, it's really different than when Mr. Abersole plays and so other people play. And Jamie is an awesome player, a very excellent musician, but he's not a, he hasn't made his life a player. And when people hear that, they can hear the difference.
Mm-hmm. I think that's...
I mean, huge. It's a very huge... And he was a little hesitant to even mention it because he thought that might be out of line saying that or asking me that question, because he had all the respect for Mr. Abersold and all that, but boy, you guys play really different, you know, and it was really innocent, and but right on. Mm. And here's a kid who basically didn't know much of anything, but he knew that.
So when you, did you make a determination that you wanted to move into composing, or did this sort of just happen? What was the next step for you there?
Well, no, it was very intentional. However, I've never studied composition, academically anyway. But I bought books and I asked a lot of questions, and I have, as you have already stated, I've had to... really the best time to play with some of the greatest composers out here. I mean, Benny Golson and Bob Brookmeyer, Thad Jones, Jimmy Heath, Slide Hampton. I mean, these are people that I have become intimately with on a lot of levels. And so I had all these things in my head, and I was always intrigued. How in the world do these people come up with all this great music? And it's original. I never heard anything like this. Mm. And so I have been intrigued with just the process of it. And when, after 20 years of teaching at William Patterson University, I decided to leave and go and get involved with this organization called the BMI Composers Orchestra Workshop, actually. BMI Composers Workshop. And that was there to just, not an arranging workshop, but a compositional workshop. And two of my greatest friends were there. Well, Bob Brookmeyer was one of the founders. And then Jim McNeely was there when I joined, and he and I have been very close friends for years. Manny Album, who was one of New York's really guru composers and arrangers, was there as coaches, and they wanted me to write what I wanted to write. And of course, I didn't know what I wanted to write, you know, because you write for movies, you write for weddings, you write music for circuses, music for parades, music for football games, basketball games, etc. But they said, well, we don't want any of those things. What do you want to write? And I tell you, it was, I didn't know what I wanted to write. It was amazing. It took me a whole year to figure out something, you know, and it was very exciting.
Was it as improvisational as it sounded like? So, you know, look, what I read was there was a book on the table of Elizabeth Catlett's music, art.
Right.
And was it as, you know, the serendipity of just opening that book and you were inspired? Is that really how it happened?
Well, pretty much, yes, because I got this commission, but the commission says, you know, we would like you to propose have some purpose, and instead of just writing a big band chart, they weren't interested in that, but the workshop was trying to get me to write something that actually you figure out a little two or three note cell, as it was called sometimes, and then just watch it grow. So you just try things, and then it grows, and then it grows. And before you know it, it becomes four bars, and it becomes eight bars, and then you expand it into more horns. And that was pretty amazing for me, to just learn how to do that. And the book was just another device or to write for being inspired by, you can be inspired by a poem, you could be inspired by the sculptures in which I did, you could be inspired by an author that you just, you know, maybe has a whole host of things. I mean, people are writing music inspired by, you know, great poets of the world. And so you needed something to kind of get started with, you know, have a reason as opposed to just, well, I like this song. I'm going to make an arrangement about it. It's not the same. And so, but I had, when I guess the thing is, like, Jim McNeely, who was one of my, like I say, one of my gurus with the workshop, he had the opportunity to write music inspired by Paul Klee in Switzerland.
Interesting.
And he wrote 10 pieces based on 10 of his paintings. There's a wonderful saxophone player, Jane Ira Bloom, who I've played a lot with.
And whom I love, I have to say.
And, I mean, she's wonderful. And I played some things that was inspired by Jackson Pollock or Kandinsky or Miro. And it was always fascinating to me that, and she would come close to at least the feeling of things. I said, wow, that's an interesting concept to compose music, and lo and behold, I began to get involved with that.
You know, I was really feeling a little stupid when I was reading this, because I was like, how is it possible that I don't know who this is? Who is Elizabeth Catlett? And then when I did the research, I realized why I was not familiar with her, because she was really... I suppose, first of all, she wasn't allowed to come into the United States after a certain point in her life, and she was really kind of kept out of the United States art community for many years.
Yes, yes. Amazing. You know, she was a very outspoken woman, but very down-to-earth, very loving and whatnot. But, I mean, she was born at the time when there was a lot of crap going on here, as it even seemingly is continuing to be going on racially and everything else. She was amazing, you know, but at the time when she was here in New York, was in the 40s and the 50s, that was a rough time for a black person to be outspoken.
And particularly to be saying that I'm a communist, right? Because I'm sure that didn't help her case very much, did it? No.
No, well, that's why they wanted the people who really knew her would like, says, well, perhaps you should go to Mexico and just kind of, while things cool off, and which she did, and so she could study the murals of Diego and all those artists in Mexico, and that basically changed her life too. But then, you know, the United States was still messing with her because they thought she was, you know, like a communist or something, whatever that means. A lot of people didn't even know what that meant, but she, but that's the shameful thing about all of that. And then eventually she was allowed to come back to the United States, and she basically said, well, you know, they just want the taxes off of my art now, you know.
And so you met her, did you not?
Yes, my wife and I, I met her. I invited her to come hear me play with Kenny Barron and Victor Lewis. We were playing at Sweet Basil at the time. She had an apartment in Lower Manhattan, and her son told me that she was coming in. April 15th was her birthday, and she would come in, obviously, for the taxes and stuff, but to go to doctor's appointments and whatnot. And so we just happened to be playing, and I said, do you think she would like, I would like to invite you guys to come by. And she did. That was, she came by on at that time, the second set started at 11:30, you know. And she came there, and she was 92, I think.
I was going to ask you that question. So she was quite peppy at her age, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She was on a walker, so her body was not being nice to her, but her brain was flying on all cylinders,
That's fabulous.
And it was amazing. And so from that we met, and she came to the house here, and then she invited my wife and I to come to Cuernavaca, to her home, and we spent a week with her, and that was amazing.
I bet.
And it was just, but it was, she reminded me quite a lot of my grandmother. It was lovely. It was, I can't even begin to tell you how wonderful that was. And it wasn't anything pretentious or anything. She was just warm and hospitable. It was just amazing. But she really liked the music. She says, I've never had anybody write that ambitious for any of my art, you know. And I wish she could have heard the Quiet Pride recording, because of the professionalism of it. You know, she heard the premiere, which was a college group that had debuted up in Connecticut.
I see, but she passed away before the album actually came out.
Correct.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so where are you headed now? I understand that London might be in your future.
Yeah, actually, we're leaving Friday.
Fabulous.
Going to take the Quiet Pride music to the Guildhall School of Music, which is, for lack of another analogy, but it's kind of like a Juilliard of London.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very high-end school, music conservatory type like school, and I mean, that's where Mary McParland went to school when she was younger, and so it's been around a while, but there we're going to do Quiet Pride there, and project the images on the screen, on the stage.
Oh my God, that sounds fabulous. Wow.
So we're very excited about that. But this past October, Elizabeth was the first black woman to get a master's in art in the 40s from the University of Iowa. She could go to school there, but they wouldn't let her stay on campus. During that time. I mean, go figure. But
oh, my God, I had to scoff at that. Is that true? My God.
Yeah. I mean, she was accepted to go to Carnegie Mellon, but then when they found out that she was, Afro-American, she couldn't go to school.
And I probably conversation for another day, but do you know where she stayed? I mean, she stayed off campus somewhere? She had to.
She had to find something.
My God.
Or something to stay in, but she was there. But last year, the University of Iowa built a new residence hall in her name.
Fabulous. You know, this is a great conversation for us to have on Martin Luther King's birthday, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it was really pretty special. And I mean, the building is the residence hall. We played a concert there, but it's really lovely to have these huge murals and photos of her. And then there's actually one of her sculptures in the student center, where everybody, not in just the museum, they actually have a museum on campus, an art gallery, but this statue is actually in the student union, which I thought was special.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
But we, University of Iowa invited me, and they brought the band that's on the recording. So it was a very special time. We did that in October. And to go to London now is amazing. It's the first time of taking the music out of the country.
And I'm feeling very left out here because I hear Iowa, I hear London. I don't hear New York or Connecticut. What's up with that?
We played it in New York at the Jazz Standard.
Ah.
I was nominated for a Grammy.
We know, yes.
And it was during that period, which was fantastic. Mm. And then we played it at the Lincoln Center atrium for one evening a couple years later. So we have played it. I haven't played it. I mean, the atrium in Lincoln Center, that was quite special too. But I would really love to play it at Jazz at Lincoln Center at some point. But I really can't complain. I've been very, very pleased with the reception, and particularly the University of Iowa was such a special time because that was her stomping grounds, and they finally, you know, paid tribute to her with the residence hall and et cetera. And now to London, and who knows where else?
I think Connecticut has to be in the future there. We'll have to think about that. Where can you do this in maybe Yale?
Well, you know, that's where it first got started, up in stores.
Ah.
That's where the first commission came from.
That's fabulous. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was that's how it came about. Raymond and Beverly Sackler have this commission, composition commission prize, and they have it administered at the University of Connecticut at Storrs, and it's primarily been classical. And the year they opened it up to jazz, and because I was part of the BMI Composers Workshop, I got on their mailing list because they were contacted, and I got it in the email, and it was for $20,000. I said, well, I don't have anything to lose. And that's why I had to figure out something to propose. You just couldn't just do music. So that's where her book that I had, and I said, well, let me do this. I'll propose to write music inspired by her art, and they accepted that, and I won.
And we are so glad because the outcome is so beautiful. It is a lovely, lovely album, and I look forward to hopefully hear it live at some point. And I want to thank you so much for your time, and you're so generous, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. I do want to ask you before you go, do you have any gigs in New York City that I could talk about?
Let me see. I'm not in New York because I'm going to be going out on the road here a little bit. I'm actually playing with a wonderful pianist. Her name is Sumi Tanooka. She's on one of my albums, but she's a wonderful pianist. And we're doing something at the Tribeca Performance Center on February the 16th, and that should be really a really good concert. Victor Lewis is going to play, and another saxophonist by the name of Erica Lindsay, who's a lives upstate New York, but she's a wonderful player. And so that's the only thing, nothing of my own. I'm going to be on the road. I guess I am going to. Do you remember the name Ricky Ford?
Of course.
Well, he's coming back to New York. He's been living in Europe for I don't know when, but there's a weekend at the Kitano.
Nice. That you'll be playing with him.
March 8th and 9th.
Fabulous. All right. Well, I will have to reach out. I usually do some ticket giveaways. So we'll have to see if I can make that happen. And again, I'm so grateful for your time, and I wish you safe travels to London. I want you to know that we're going to, when we let you off the phone, the next thing folks are going to hear is your album with Frank Kimbrough.
Ooh, yes.
Fabulous.
All the monk music. That was a special one.
You'll have to come back, because I would love to talk to you about that, but I have to get ready for the next programmer, so I'm going to have to say adios to you and safe travels. And thank you again. And we are listener-supported radio, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, 89.5 FM. That was the legend, Rufus Reed here. He is a phenomenal bassist and also composer, and he has a beautiful album. It's called Quiet Pride. And in addition, he has a new album out with Frank Kimbrough that we are going to hear from right now.
Thank you. I dreamed of a life that was pure and true. I dreamed of a job only I could do. One man beside me, we'd be a team. Man, that was a dream. I dreamed it was music I had to play. I dreamed when I played I would play my way. Two fascinating children, Boo-Boo and Toot. Dreams, that was a feud. All through life I'd be true. Fortune would come my way. Struggling and getting by, trying to never lie, mean exactly what I say. I dreamed I had fame and a life supply. I dreamed I made prints on the sands of time. Smack dab in the spotlight, bathing his beam. Man, that was my dream.
Thank you.
pleasure to be here with you today. I am so excited. Pete Stewart comes up next at 4 o'clock. It's a few minutes away from there. I did want to tell you, I have these tickets to give away to the Side Door Jazz, and I haven't had someone take me up on that yet. So this is Ben Wolf on January 25th at Side Door Jazz at the Old Lyme Inn in Old Lyme, Connecticut. So if you are interested in acquiring those tickets for January 25th, this is Ben Wolf, who is another bassist, by the way, and fabulous music. We heard from him a little bit earlier. Call now at 203-331-9756. That number again is 203-331-9756 for a pair of tickets to see Ben Wolf at the Side Door Jazz. And I'll be back next Tuesday, 1 to 4. Dave Golden is taking over for me tomorrow. See you then.
This is Mark the Mechanic from the Car Bob Show. While we always try to steer you in the right direction towards repairing your car, there is that time when you just need to say goodbye to your old friend. This is what's so special about WPKN. If we can't tell you how to fix your car, we can help you get rid of it. Donate your car to WPKN and receive a generous tax deduction. And you are helping WPKN with the funds needed to keep this great radio station going 24/7 with the best programming heard anywhere. It's very simple. Go to WPKN.org, click on the car key, All the instructions are there to help make the whole process as easy as possible. Once again, I want to thank you for your continuing support and being a part of your community radio station, WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org.
He's got a car that doesn't go.
Hi, this is Casey Ryan. I've been a WPKN listener, volunteer, and sometimes even a programmer for almost 30 years. Yeah, I really do love this quirky little radio station, which is why for several years now, I've also been a sustaining supporter. Each month, I automatically contribute an amount I chose, an amount I hardly miss, but that really helps when it comes to paying WPKN's bills. Every time I listen to WPKN and I hear that reminder about it being listener supported, I think, hey, I'm one of those listeners who are supporting it. Yay me! Now I'm asking you to consider joining me. Just go to our website, WPKN.org, and tap the donate button. It's a simple process to become a monthly sustaining WPKN supporter. And trust me, it feels so good to be one.
And now your plastic-free minute.
There's a crisis going on. It's in our air, our water, our food chain, and even inside our bodies. It's big enough to see with the naked eye and small enough to only see with a microscope. But to be sure, it's there. There is no away. Plastic pieces like cups, straws, and to-go containers are being used and discarded as if they have somewhere to go. The truth is that plastic and their chemicals are ending up in our bodies and all over our environment because they don't have anywhere to go. Every bit of plastic created still exists in some form. Recycling is not enough. Often items put in recycling bins actually end up in landfills, the ocean, or are incinerated. The good news is that this crisis is man-made and therefore can be man-unmade. Please stop and think the next time you go for single-use plastic, refuse single-use. Or make the choice to bring your own reusable items like a cup, bottle, or cutlery. I'm Ed Begley, Jr., and this has been your Plastic Free Minute. Learn more at plasticpollutioncoalition.org.
Hi, I'm Lou with Citizens Campaign for the Environment, here to tell you how you can protect our water by properly disposing of unused prescription medications.
Prescription medications? What does the way I dispose of my old drugs have to do with protecting our water?
Everything. Most people still don't know that the old method of flushing unused medications contaminates Long Island Sound with steroids, hormones, and antibiotics.
Wow.
This affects our drinking water, rivers, harbors, and it affects our aquatic wildlife too.
That's awful. I want cream and sugar in my coffee, not steroids and antidepressants. Pharmaceuticals in the water can't be good for fish. What can I do to help?
Well, the good news is that towns across the state are offering new locations for residents to safely and anonymously dispose of their unused and expired drugs. If your town does not have a disposal program, you can always crush tablets or empty capsules into the garbage.
How do I find out more?
Visit citizenscampaign.org to find a safe disposal location near you and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
I get it. Don't flush your drugs.
I'm Jeannie Burris, president of Near and Far Aid. We're an all-volunteer organization targeting poverty and changing lives right here in Fairfield County. Please visit our website at www.nearandfaraid.org to find out how you can help.
Monday morning blues can be a good thing.
And if that doesn't work, how about some rock therapy?
Wake up and start your work week every Monday morning with Mark Mushin
or Rob Stilber from 7 to 9 a.m.